Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear the 24th Women in Health Lecture, presented annually by the Center for Health Policy and Ethics at Creighton University. The guest speaker will be Monique Truong, author of The Book of Salt and Bitter in the Mouth. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, October 1st, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Christy Rentmeester, Associate Professor in the Center for Health Policy and Ethics.
I introduce to you the writer that you've all come to see, Monique Truong. She holds a Bachelor of Arts in Literature from Yale and a Juris Doctorate from Columbia University. She practices intellectual property law, and for her writing, has earned numerous national and international awards and fellowships, including the Hodder Fellowship at Princeton, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and she was a visiting writer at the Helsinki Collegium. Recently, her work on immigration and assimilation experiences was honored by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. She has completed numerous international writing residencies, including the prestigious Breadloaf Writers Conference in Middlebury, Vermont. She has just returned from a residency in Italy, and I think the last talk that she gave was in the Piazza del Popolo. Monique Truong's first novel, The Book of Salt, has now been published in 14 countries. Her second novel, Bitter in the Mouth, has now been published in 5 countries with abundant lauds. She is the anthology editor of the innovative Watermark, Vietnamese-American Poetry and Prose, and the author of widely published works of short fiction and nonfiction essays. Her scholarly approach to historical fiction and to culinary writing honors the art and contributions of those who inspire her prose. She is also a devoted servant and promoter of the arts and many humanities organizations. Monique says on her website, when she is not writing, which is most of the time, she cooks and takes naps. She has been known to walk long distances, especially if there is a good bakery around the corner. Ladies and gentlemen, Monique Truong.
Hello. Good evening. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you so much to Professor Rentmeester for that lovely, lovely introduction. And you might not want people to know this, but we met on Facebook. And I'm very glad that we did. Okay. Well, it's true that I just came back to the United States after a month of being in Italy. In particular, I was in Sicily. So I hope you'll forgive me if I wrote everything down, because I don't think I could really sort of have this talk in my jet lag sort of condition without it being on paper. So the name of the talk tonight is Writing with an Insulin Pen. I'll begin with a simple assertion. We cannot understand the power and the meaning of food until we understand hunger. Hunger, at its most basic, is the lack of food, and therefore our body's need and craving for food. If we are very lucky in this world, we feel hunger as a minor physical discomfort that can be easily, quickly sated. A sandwich to go, a bag of chips from a vending machine, a cup of soup in the microwave. Hunger, of course, can also mean a craving for something that food represents or promises, but somehow has failed to deliver to us. The ritual of sitting down to a meal. Now, is this not the theater of community and family? Eating a dish prepared by someone who cares for you and your well-being? Is this not the tangible representation of love and caring? And then there's the intake of flavors, vivid and deep, nurtured by the sunlight above and the earth beneath our feet. Is this not the epitome of a sense of place and the pleasure of belonging? It is the latter form of hunger, the hunger of the spirit, more so than the body, though they are, of course, often intertwined, that my novels and essays fixate on. In my 46 years of life, there have been acute and formative moments of hunger, moments that have altered and shaped my perspective on food and my imaginative relationship to it as well. Tonight, I'd like to share some of these moments with you, along with brief excerpts from my work that stem from them directly and indirectly. The title of my talk, Writing with an Insulin Pen, is because I am a diabetic, and I've lived with diabetes for the past 22 years. And it's one of these formative moments of hunger for me. Diabetes has, I would say, provoked, irritated, embedded itself within, heightened, and ultimately it's enhanced my life as a writer. Now, given my medical history, it may surprise you that I choose to write about food again and again. The name of my first two novels, The Book of Salt and Bitter in the Mouth, and of my novel in progress, The Sweetest Fruits, are a reference to three of the four basic tastes. I've joked that I'm saving sour for the title of my memoir, or rather a play on its cousin, the word tart. The London-based chef and cookbook author, Yotam Ottolenghi, has a delicious recipe for a savory pie that's full of tomatoes and eggplants, which he calls a very full tart. That, I think, would be an excellent title for a memoir. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's begin with when I was the most hungry. I can trace that first hunger back to April of 1975, when my family and I came to the U.S. as refugees from the Vietnam War. As refugees, we were held at a relocation camp, which in our case was Camp Pendleton in California. After my first novel was published, I was invited by the Penn Faulkner Foundation to write a brief response to Eudora Welty's autobiography entitled One Writer's Beginning. I was asked to trace my memories back to the moment when storytelling became a necessity for me. I found myself back at Camp Pendleton, and what I found there was a ridiculously symbolic first meal. I'd like to share that memory with you, and it's really my first lesson regarding the many guises that hunger can take. My memories have always been sealed with a taste. I remember people, places, moments by the foods that I consumed while in their presence or within their geography. In April of 1975, when I was six, I was at a Marine Corps base in California. It had been turned into a refugee camp, and my mother and I were among the thousands of Vietnamese assigned to its hastily set up tents. Each tent, each canvas A-frame deployable structure was a site of loss. Being human and being Vietnamese, we who say, "Have you eaten?" when we mean, "How are you?" We, the inhabitants of this camp, tried to fill our emptiness by keeping our stomach full. Food was provided to us from the back of truck beds. The lines were always long. Some lines led to baked chicken, which was popular. Some led to unidentifiable masses covered in cheese, which were not popular. Some led to apples, some to oranges, and bananas always cleared the tents. In my family, which had grown suddenly so small, I was the gatherer. I stood in line for my mother, but she ate little of what I brought back, except for the fruits. One night, in some fit of desperation and madness, and probably hunger, she sent me to the camp's officers' club with a note and a $20 bill. I can't remember how I made my way to the building, which was, of course, off limits to the refugees. I can't remember to whom I handed the note, nor how long it took or what I did while I was waiting. I don't remember whether I got any change back. I do remember returning to the tent with a paper bag, that inside there were foil packets and that they were warm. I remember eating with my mother our first real meal in the United States, hamburgers and fries. How could the truth be such a cliche? This memory is buried so deep in me that when it does emerge, it's a surprise to me. I have to ask myself, could that have really happened? Then I think about that note. What did my mother write? Was it formal and businesslike, the way that English can often be when the writers acquire it in a faraway country? Dear sir or madam, please, we would like to place an order. Or was it stark and clear in the way that grief can strip us all of artifice? I am 31 years old, and I have a $20 bill, and I have one child. Please take the money. Please send the child back to me along with the food. P.S. Where's my husband? Whatever my mother wrote that night, they were the first English words to feed me. That note, the persistence of it in my memory, the taste that it still serves forth, and the speculation of what it could have said are the reasons why those words will always be the beginning of the story for me. Now, in retrospect, of course, I understand that all those thousands of people standing in the long lines hour and hour for food were in shock, they were in grief, unmoored, but the one thing that they probably were not was physically hungry, especially considering the food at Camp Pendleton. And yet food was the obsession there, the sole focus and task of the long days of otherwise not knowing what would come next. So instead of the larger, overwhelming, unimaginable answers, we refugees focused on which truck had the fresher fruits, which one had chicken, which one was trying to service something called egg foo young, a Chinese-American invention that we certainly did not recognize. Now, after leaving the refugee camp, the first place that my family and I lived was a very small town in North Carolina called Boiling Springs, where we found the food to be not as dismal, but almost. In Boiling Springs, I experienced a different kind of hunger, particularly America in the mid-1970s hunger, brought about by processed, frozen, canned, instant, and fast foods. My family and I, for example, could not understand why the only rice that we could buy at the market was labeled converted. What religion was it before? We joked. We learned that it meant that the rice had been partially cooked, a process that resulted in the grains not sticking together, as if the grains touching one another was a sin. We could not understand why coffee had been granulated and made instant, in the process made sour and chemical tasting. Why potatoes, green beans, and carrots had been canned. Why food could be purchased without ever leaving our car. Actually, we liked that novelty very much. The American car promised speed, and food purchased while sitting inside a car was the promise of speed optimized. Though flavor was often left behind. Boiling Springs, a town so tiny that I now describe it as a freckle on the face of the Carolinas, was our home for 3 years, long enough for my mom to acquire a southern accent and for me to become fluent in the English language and to acquire an unreasonable affection for buttermilk biscuits and sugar-cured country ham. Then, like pioneers heading ever westward, my parents packed up for Centerville, Ohio, and eventually for Houston, Texas. When I was finally able to choose my own city to call home, I headed eastward. In 1992, I was 24 years old. I was living in New York City and in my first year at Columbia Law School. Two facts that explain why I had lost nearly 50 pounds and was constantly lethargic and bone tired. Or so I told myself. New York City is truly a metropolis where you cannot be thin enough. So when the pounds, like magic, dropped from my 5'4 frame, leaving me at 95 pounds, I was elated. I thought of it as a blessing, a minor miracle given the foods that I was consuming. If there's one thing that Columbia Law taught me, it was that a bagel and cream cheese was the New York City's equivalent to a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Perfect for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. As for the other lessons of law school, I learned after the first week of classes that I was in the wrong place and among the wrong people. My fellow law school students were clearly intelligent, but as I would later write, some people were smart like a whip, while others were brilliant like a diamond. My fellow law school students were definitely whips. For the first time in my academic life, I was also an average student. And worst of all, I didn't have an ounce of desire to do anything about it. For me, this emotional malaise seemed to go hand in hand with the physical weariness that I was experiencing. And in addition, I was also constantly thirsty, a kind of thirst that I had never experienced before. I was parched, as if the inside of me was a grassy lawn baking in the July sun, or a pair of lips that desperately needed to be licked. A glass of water, or more often orange juice, was not nearly enough to quench the thirst. I was not so much drinking orange juice. I was gulping and chugging it a quart at a time. Because of all the liquids that I was consuming, I was also getting up in the middle of the night 2-3 times to urinate. I hadn't had an uninterrupted night of sleep in months, which certainly didn't help with my low energy level during the day. I also had one yeast infection after another, and that was finally the indicator that I recognized, an indicator that my body was in distress. I did some quick research and found that these symptoms taken together, the rapid weight loss, excessive thirst, frequent urination, and reoccurring yeast infections were classic symptoms of a female body with uncontrolled diabetes. After essentially diagnosing myself, I made an appointment at University Health Services to confirm it. The doctor there tested the level of glucose or sugar in my blood with a simple finger prick test. The small drop of blood on the glucometer's test strip showed that my blood sugar level was in the high 500s. A normal range for someone who hasn't eaten for 8 hours or more is between 70 and 99. And a random test like mine should have resulted in a number of 200 or less. There wasn't a doubt. I was a diabetic. There are, as many of you know, two types of diabetes. Type 1, previously known as juvenile diabetes, is when your pancreas is no longer producing insulin, the hormone that allows your body to convert carbohydrates, such as sugar, starches, dietary fibers, and absorb them as energy. Type 2, sometimes known as adult onset diabetes, though increasingly more children are being diagnosed with it, is when your pancreas still produces insulin, but your body is unable to use it effectively because of obesity or some other slowing down of your body's metabolic rate. Now, after additional more extensive blood tests, and given my medical history and my family's medical history, my doctor would eventually diagnose me with what he called type 1.5 diabetes. Because of another undiagnosed condition known as hypothyroidism, my thyroid gland was not producing enough hormones, and therefore my metabolic rate had slowed considerably, causing the initial weight gain, which then triggered type 2 diabetes. In addition, my pancreas was also slowing its production of insulin, which placed me in the borderline type 1 territory. At the age of 24, my body, like me, was underachieving in an unprecedented way. But all of this information would come later. That day, when I left the doctor's office with my diagnosis, I took with me prescriptions for vials of insulin and syringes. I had also been given a crash course by a nurse on how to inject myself. She had me practice on an orange. Now, allow me to state the obvious. Inserting the needle into an orange is a vastly different experience from injecting yourself in the stomach or the outer thighs, two of the preferred injection sites because there tends to be fat deposits there and thus less painful. I've never been particularly squeamish about needles, but that did not mean that I could inject myself in my stomach without many minutes of mental preparation in order to tamp down my fear. I was also instructed that day to buy a glucometer, which is a small device that fits in the palm of your hand, and test strips so that I could monitor my blood sugar levels multiple times a day. This meant more self-administered pain, this time courtesy of a lancet, in order to prick the sides of my fingers near their tips. The injections and the finger pricks I eventually got used to. Over the years, the technology improved and the needles for the syringes became thinner and shorter, and now I, like many diabetics, use an insulin pen, which looks like a fat pen and has a needle only half a millimeter in length. It's almost painless, discreet, much easier to travel with. As for the glucometer and the finger pricks, that has also become second nature to me as well, which is not the same as saying that I've been consistent and diligent over the years about testing for the 6 times a day, as I am doing now. It just means that I no longer find it strange to self-puncture my skin, draw blood to its surface, and receive an instant reading of my body's function or malfunction. I'll tell you the thing that has never been easy, and that continues to challenge me each and every day. It's the long list of foods and drinks, high in carbs, especially sugars, that I can no longer consume without guilt, shame, remorse, and the inescapable knowledge of what these foods can do and will do to my body. Now, since I became a refugee at the age of 6, food for me had already ceased to be merely sustenance, simple and filling. Instead, it's already a source of solace and pleasure, a reminder of the country, culture, and language that I have left behind. And food was also that tantalizing promise, the ever hopeful possibility of feeling at home, if not in the world, then at least at the dinner table. Now that's a lot to ask and to expect from a plate of food. But after I was diagnosed with diabetes, food took on another set of meanings for me. Food became temptation, an exercise of will, a loss of control, an assertion of power, and a relinquishment thereof. Food became a drug, and it became a poison. Of course, anyone who has ever tried to go on a diet and failed knows that this is the flip side of a good meal. As a diabetic, I feel as if I have been on a nonstop diet, often unsuccessfully and often failing, for 22 years now. Enjoyment is always tempered. Desire is always cut by the numerical calibration of what would soon follow. Not on the scale, per se, but via the glucometer. Food cravings often consume and color my thoughts. And there is hunger in every bite that I take. Hunger for when food was not barbed, mined, and riddled by the immediate and long-term consequences. Like how language had become for me when I came to the U.S., food was now no longer natural to me. I had to relearn it. I had to break it down into its smallest components in order to understand it again. How many grams of carbohydrates in a bagel? Of those grams, how many are sugar? How many are dietary fiber? What flour was used to make the bagel? Was it white flour, which breaks down into sugar so fast that it causes my blood sugar levels to spike? Or was it whole wheat or some other whole grains, which break down slower, but will nonetheless raise my glucose levels over the course of a day? A bagel made from white flour has about 48 grams of carbohydrates. By way of comparison, a 12-ounce can of Coca-Cola has 38.5 grams. Needless to say, I have not enjoyed the simple pleasure and the convenience of a bagel and cream cheese, or a Coke, since 1992. Yet, I began tonight by saying that my diabetes has heightened and ultimately enhanced my life as a writer. It's taken me many years to reach this conclusion. And I do believe it's true. I am a writer obsessed by food. But my obsession, I believe, is a clear-eyed one. I do not simply celebrate, venerate, or elevated. I do not wear rose-colored glasses when I write about food in my fiction or my nonfiction. My lenses instead are those of the microscope, the jeweler's loop, the bifocal glasses, and even the telescope, because sometimes we must stand very far away from something in order to see it clearly and to appreciate it within its larger context. Now, here is the larger context. Diabetes is an epidemic in the U.S. According to the American Diabetes Association, diabetes was the 7th leading cause of death in the U.S. in 2010. In 2012, 29.1 million Americans, or 9.3% of the population, had been diagnosed with diabetes. I would add to this my own observation that type 2 diabetes is a symptom of our nation's nutritional hunger. The cheapest, most widely available, most convenient, time-saving of foods are also the foods that have been processed and manufactured to give us a quick fix in terms of their flavors, high in sugar or high in salt, in terms of their high calorie count. In short, foods that fill our stomachs, keep our wallets full, and yet are in fact starving us. I use the word starve not as a metaphor. One of the symptoms of uncontrolled diabetes is rapid weight loss, because the body is breaking down its own fat deposits in order to obtain energy. Diabetes used to be called the wasting disease because sufferers appeared to waste away from the excessive and rapid weight loss. It is, I think, sometimes easy to forget this nutritional hunger aspect of diabetes and its epidemic because words like obesity are used to describe what can trigger the disease. Obesity is not simply about the overconsumption of food. Obesity is also about overconsuming foods that harm the body more than aid the body. My own body complicated food for me many years ago, and my brain has had to learn to adapt and process these complications, fashioning them into additional, more expansive, and I think ultimately richer ways of understanding the alimentary and the culinary. So, what does it mean for me to write with an insulin pen? It means that every word that I write is a testament to the lessons that I have learned and continue to learn about what my body needs to survive. My body and my diabetes, in turn, are constant reminders to me that to survive is not the same as to thrive, and to eat is not the same as to nourish, and that food is a necessity and it's a gift that we give to our bodies. Food, at its very best, is when we can see the faces of the people who grew it, harvested it, cooked it, and served it to us. When one of these links is missing, there is a void, which is inevitably reflected in the lowered quality of the food and the lowered quality that this food can have for our bodies and our lives. So I want to conclude tonight with sharing a short passage from my second novel, Bitter in the Mouth. And I think it will hopefully illustrate for you sort of the complicated relationship that I have with food and the way that it has sort of manifested itself in my imagination. And it'll also explain some of this. Okay, so for Bitter in the Mouth, I actually returned to Boiling Springs, North Carolina, for the inspiration and the locale. Bitter in the Mouth is a novel that is about a young woman named Linda Hamrick who has a neurological condition called synesthesia. When she speaks or hears certain words, the words trigger flavor for her. You can see examples there. I want the flavors of Linda's words to stand as a testament and really as an homage to the flavors of my youth in Boiling Springs. And I wanted to make clear one of the lasting lessons of the hunger that I had experienced in Boiling Springs and elsewhere, which is that food can exacerbate or it can ameliorate one's sense of displacement or difference. One more thing before I begin the passage. One of the challenges of writing this novel was trying to understand how I would represent on the page Linda's condition. I chose to do it in this way. In the book, whenever she hears or speaks a word that triggers a flavor for her, like her name Linda, the word appears in regular type and with no space in between, then the flavor appears in italics. So Linda Mint. What I have found, though, that it's very difficult for me when I read from the book to sort of read in italics. So, in this passage, as fair warning, you're going to hear the word again. And the flavor that it triggers for her is pancake, no syrup. I had just learned the trick of stringing together words to produce the taste that I wanted. I was particularly fond of this bread, walnut, elephant, candle, jogger. These words brought forth the following in this satisfying order: ham steak, sugar cured, and pan fried. Sweet potatoes, baked with lots of butter. 7-Up, though more the lime than the lemon, like when it's icy cold. Fresh strawberries, sweet and ripe. Growing up with Deanne for a mother, I could count on one hand the times that I have had a really good meal like that. Every once in a while, an ingredient would slip past Deanne's fingers unspoiled. Fresh strawberries, for example. During the summers, my great uncle Harper and I would go to the Pick Your Own farms in the nearby town of Kings Mountain, and the berries that we brought back were so red, perfect, and fragrant that even Deanne left them alone. That was perhaps my favorite memory of my mother. Her walking out of the kitchen with a cut glass bowl full of strawberries. A bowl of Cool Whip would be waiting at the table for them, but I never touched this stuff. Not after my great uncle Harper called it edible shaving cream. I didn't understand until I had left Boiling Springs, and specifically the sphere of influence of Deanne's kitchen, why so many of the incomings of my childhood were mildly unpleasant, bland, or unremarkable at best. The reason was disarmingly simple. The experiential flavors had to come first, Once the memories of them, of the can frozen, the surprise, the a la king, had lodged themselves in my brain, then and only then could these tastes attach themselves to the words in my vocabulary without cause or consideration for the meanings of the words. I, too, had to disregard the meanings of the words if I wanted to enjoy what the words could offer me. At first, the letting go of meaning was a difficult step for me to take, like loosening my fingers from the side of a swimming pool for the very first time. The world suddenly became vast and fluid. Anything could happen to me as I drifted toward the deep end of the pool. But without words resourceful and revealing, who would know of the dangers that I faced? I would be defenseless. I would drown. Maybe all children felt this way. We grab onto words because we thought that they could save us. Mama got us a pair of hands, a bosom to hide our faces in. Papa got us a lift skyward, a perch on a shoulder. Maybe our first words all had the same meaning. Save me. A plea that, if answered, reinforced our desire to acquire more, to amass a vocabulary that could be our arsenal against the unknown terrors of life. To let go of meaning was to allow for the possibility that words didn't hold within them this promise of salvation, or because of my misuse of the words, I alone wouldn't be saved. Of course, I was afraid. The first time I did it, it was out of necessity. I was hungry. And the casserole du jour was chicken a la king, my least favorite in Deanne's rotation. As she scooped it onto our plates, she announced its name as if we had never seen this dish before. As usual, there were gray slices of canned mushrooms to which the thick, dun-colored sauce refused to adhere. A repulsion on a molecular level, perhaps. The sauce stuck to the egg noodles and the chicken pieces instead, lending its gluey, spongy textures to both the starch and the meat. I excused myself from the dinner table to go wash my hands, and then I, a skinny 11-year-old, sat on the edge of the bathtub and blurted out, "Not again. Pancake, no syrup." There it was. Sustenance, simple, without sauce. Each repetition of the word again was a revelation. The faster I said it, the more intense and mouth-filling the taste became. Each repetition was a restitution for past meals suffered. Each repetition was an inoculation for future meals to be endured. I wanted to see how many times I would have to say the word in order to approximate the feeling of being full. I flipped on the bathroom fan so that no one would hear. Soon, a knock on the bathroom door, and my father's voice saying my name in the form of a question made me stop short. Why hadn't I stumbled on this simple solution before? I had edged close to it. I had learned that the word could diminish and deflect. I was slower to understand that the word could also fulfill and satisfy. But let me ask you this question. How old were you when you first touched yourself for the sake of pleasure? Your body and its attendant parts were always there, were they not? But we all have to learn how to use what we were born with for something other than the functional and the obvious. All of our bodies hold within them secret chambers and cells. Thank you. Questions? Okay, great first question. Which came first? Diabetes, the food you eat, etc., or your desire or need to write on the subject of food? In other words, did you always want to write? The reply is simple, yes, I always wanted to write. I was the kind of little kid who would keep a little journal. But I don't think that my writing at that time had necessarily was fixated on food. But I do have to say that when I was when we came to the United States and started living in Boiling Springs, I developed a very sort of almost magical thinking kind of relationship with food. And it was in this way. So I was 7 years old, and I truly believed that if I ate more American food, I would be more American, and I wouldn't be picked on so much at school. I would blend in. So my mother, who is a wonderful, wonderful cook, she cooks Vietnamese, cooks French, but she was not necessarily very interested in cooking American food. So that was something I had to do for myself, and I started reading cookbooks. I think I have read the Betty Crocker cookbook from, you know, cover to cover. I've read The Joy of Cooking from cover to cover. I mean, that's not so unusual, but at the age of 7, I think that is unusual. And so maybe I would say that this is why I began the talk about talking about the refugee experience and how food, you know, took on a whole sort of set of meanings at that point. And then the diabetes sort of gave me the flip side of, or another side of that sort of, the flip side of how it would sort of function in my imagination. So the timeline would be, I write. I always wanted to write. I wanted to cook because I thought it would make me, quote-unquote, more normal, more American. And then I think it was the diabetes that really, it made me a more mature thinker about food. And I think without it, I might be, you know, maybe, hopefully, still a good writer, but maybe just a good, you know, maybe a magazine writer who could give you a lovely article about, you know, the joys of a summer tomato, which is beautiful. But I think with the diabetes, it made me think about who is, you know, sort of that, what is making that tomato so beautiful? Is it the pesticide? Is it, you know, how does it get to our table? How all the sort of complexities around that beautiful thing that we want to enjoy and would love to enjoy. Why not an insulin pump? I think I know who wrote this. For those of you who don't know what an insulin pump is, it's basically a device that many diabetics use now, and it's a catheter that is is attached to your body, and it's a way to really sort of manage your insulin intake in a very much more effective way. I have no response except that it takes me a long time to sort of, I think like anybody else, to sort of, to just sort of, you know, to change. And that would be a change in my life. So that's, but hopefully, I'll explore it further. Okay. In Bitter in the Mouth, was Linda Mint's father also her maybe something father? Her real father?
I don't have my glasses.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think I know the question. How to answer this without just giving away a huge spoiler. let's talk about it this way. There's a lot of Linda Hamrick is a character whom you meet, and very early on, you know that she has this neurologic condition, that she tastes words. You know where she lives, which is in a small town in the South in the mid-70s. You know she gives you descriptions of her parents, her great-uncle, her grandmother. And there are certain assumptions that I'm inviting the reader to make about Linda. And what I can tell you is that as the novel goes on, the novel is told in the first-person voice of Linda, you find out that there is more and more about her that makes her... that sets her apart from her community, from her family, and it's only through, she would say it's only when she feels safe that she'll tell you the truth. So there's a lot of questions that are raised about her family. And whoever wrote that question, I'll be happy to respond to you one-on-one. But I think there's a certain joy that I hope that you'll get in figuring out the mystery of this character and her family. And that's one of the mysteries, is her father. Okay. Do people without diabetes understand what you are talking about? I have the BDs, and I do. Huh. I think that's a question for the audience. Do you understand what I'm talking about? Yeah? Yes, clearly if you are if you have diabetes, this will be sort of like almost like a mind meld, what I just said up here. But I think that even if this is, if you have, and I would be honestly very surprised if you don't have friends or a family member who is a diabetic or is a borderline diabetic, that I think even if you are the most healthy human being with no food issues whatsoever, I think you can understand when something becomes an obsession, you know, and becomes something that you had taken so for granted. And this is why I made that connection between diabetes and language, you know, how language at a certain point became no longer a natural thing to me, and then food all of a sudden became something that was no longer a natural thing to me. There are certain things that we take for granted. You know, we are born into a language and we learn it and we speak it and we don't think about its components. But when you learn a second language and you do have to think about its grammar and its construction, then often you end up knowing that language in a way, and in an intellectual way, and in a way that is often can be deeper than your mother tongue, you know. And so I think food became that to me too. Food is something I eat, something I enjoy, you know, something that gave me a certain kind of pleasure, a certain evocation of home. But I never thought about it as something that was dangerous, or perhaps even political, or even, you know, poisonous, until my diagnosis. And then it was never the same again. And I think that, it, like I said, it enriched the way that I see the whole production of food, the whole construction of food. So hopefully that was something that came across. Yeah. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard the 24th Women in Health Lecture, presented annually by the Center for Health Policy and Ethics at Creighton University. The guest speaker has been Monique Trong, author of The Book of Salt and Bitter in the Mouth. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, October 1st, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.